Hello, and welcome to this presentation about National Insurance Contributions. This presentation will start by looking briefly at the structure of National Insurance Contributions system, in the light of the fact that while National Insurance Contributions are a cost, they also give entitlement to benefits. We will then consider the impact of National Insurance Contributions on employments from the point of view of both the employer and the employee, looking at contributions on both cash and non-cash remuneration. This will be followed by a review of how National Insurance Contributions apply to the self-employed. As multiple sources of earned income, both employed and self-employed, are becoming increasingly common, we'll look at the maxima and deferral rules which apply in these circumstances. Finally, we'll consider the situation where it may be beneficial to make voluntary contributions and how these operate. There are six types of National Insurance Contribution, and we're going to look at each of them in turn. Let's begin by saying what they are. Firstly, Class 1, earnings-related contributions divided into primary and secondary. Primary Class 1 contributions are those which are collected by deduction from wages and salaries subject to the pay-as-you-earn scheme. Most, but not all, of these contributions give the employee entitlement to benefits. Secondary Class 1 contributions also have to be accounted for under the pay-as-you-earn scheme, but these are purely a payroll tax on employers and do not give entitlements to any benefits. Class 1A contributions are paid by employers on the taxable value of benefits in kind reported on Form P11D. Like secondary Class 1 contributions, they are purely a payroll tax on employers. Their purpose is simply to ensure that there is no NIC incentive for employers to provide benefits in kind instead of cash remuneration. Similarly, Class 1B contributions are due where benefits in kind cannot be reported on Form P11D and therefore income tax and National Insurance Contributions are settled directly with HM Revenue and Customs by the employer. Class 2 are the flat rate contributions paid by the self-employed. They give the self-employed the right to contributory benefits. Class 3 are flat rate voluntary contributions which can be important in maintaining entitlement to benefits for those not otherwise liable to NICs. Finally, Class 4 earnings related contributions are paid by the self-employed in addition to Class 2. Apart from being earnings related, they differ from Class 2 in that whereas Class 2 gives entitlement to benefits, Class 4 are, like secondary Class 1 contributions, merely a form of taxation. This presentation cannot go into the detailed conditions which have to be fulfilled before state benefits can be obtained, but it is important to be aware of the types of benefits where entitlement is based on contributions. This is because a saving in National Insurance Contributions may not be worth pursuing if it causes a substantial loss of entitlement to benefits. Broadly, benefits which are designed to alleviate specific types of hardship or disadvantage are not contributory. Examples are social fund payments, attendance allowance, carer's allowance, child benefit, housing benefit, and income support. The only non-contributory pensions are Category D, for those over 80 with inadequate contributions. Other forms of state pension rely on contributions and are scaled down if contributions are insufficient. On the other hand, benefits linked to the world of work are dependent on contributions. Examples are job seekers allowance, statutory sick pay, statutory maternity pay, statutory paternity pay and statutory adoption pay. Also contributory are incapacity benefit, maternity allowance, bereavement allowance and widow parents allowance. The key area in this context is entitlement to Category A and B state pension, as retiring employees are often disappointed in their state pension entitlement caused by gaps in their contribution record which they were not aware of. Entitlement to basic state pension is based on the percentage of contributions over a working life, currently 39 years for women, 44 for men. From April 2010, the requirement for all employees will be 30 years contributions. Entitlement to additional earnings-related state pension under the former State Earnings-Related Pension Scheme, which ran from 1978 to 2002, and the current State Second Pension Scheme from 2002, is calculated based on contributions over an employee's working life. The two systems are broadly similar, but the state second pension scheme is designed, in accordance with government policy, to favour lower earners. We now move on to look in more detail at Class 1 contributions in relation to employees. Class 1 contributions are paid by both the employer and the employee if earnings are above the primary threshold, which in recent years has approximated to the annual exemption for income tax. No contributions are due on earnings below the primary threshold, and contributions at 11% are due between the primary threshold and the upper earnings limit. The upper earnings limit is intended by the government to approximate to the total of the income tax personal allowance plus the basic rate band, that is, the point at which higher rate income tax starts to be paid. Insofar as earnings are above the upper earnings limit, the employee only pays at 1%, but full contributions from the employer are still required. In the past, before 1977, married women could elect to pay reduced contributions on the basis that they would individually accrue no pension entitlement and would rely on pension rights accrued on the basis of their husband's contributions. If an election was made, it will still be valid, if not revoked. And where it applies, a reduced rate of contributions is applicable, in return for having no entitlement to state pension. This is an area which must be treated with caution, as many women are now coming up to retirement age and regretting their earlier decision to forego personal entitlement to state pension. Employee contributions cease at state pension age, currently 65 for men, 60 for women, but employer contributions continue. No contributions are due in respect of children under 16. Let's now have a look at the limits and thresholds which apply. We will look at them on a weekly basis for simplicity, but of course equivalent monthly and annual figures are available. We've already said that contributions start at the primary threshold, £110 for 2009-10. However, below this is the lower earnings limit, and all earnings above that limit give entitlement to benefits. This means that for employees with earnings above the lower earnings limit, but not exceeding the primary threshold, no contributions are due, although a return must be filed by the employer, but entitlement to benefits is obtained. For earnings above the primary threshold and up to the upper earnings limit, full contributions are due from both the employer and the employee. Above the upper earnings limit, only 1% contributions are due from the employee, but full employer contributions continue. Up to and including 2008-09, employee contributions between the primary threshold and the upper earnings limit gave entitlement to state second pension. This changes from 2009-10 with the introduction of the upper accruals point. In future, the top slice of employee contributions between the upper accruals point and the upper earnings limit will accrue no pension benefits. These contributions, like the 1% payable above the upper earnings limit, are a pure tax and are not related to any benefits. Notice that all these limits are increased every year in line with other tax rates and allowances, but the upper accruals point will remain fixed at £770, so as to increasingly restrict the state second pension accrual as time moves on. The government estimate that as a result of this, by about 2030, the state second pension will effectively become a flat rate rather than earnings related. We've already mentioned some of the rates which apply, but let's now look at the whole picture. There are no contributions on the first £110 of earnings, and then for employees, the band between £110 and £844 is liable at 11%. Beyond that, with no upper limit, the 1% rate applies. For employers, the rate above £110 is 12.8% with no upper limit. As contributions above the primary threshold give entitlement to state second pension, it is possible for employees who have an occupational pension scheme giving equivalent benefits to contract out of the state second pension scheme and in return to pay contributions reduced by 1.6%, that is from 11% to 9.4%. Until 2008-09, the The reduction was on the whole 11% band between the primary threshold and the upper earnings limit. But from 2009-10, it's only up to the upper accruals point, and full contributions have to be paid between that point and the upper earnings limit, whereupon the 1% rate starts. The result of this structural change is that contracted out employees on relatively high earnings will see a substantial increase in their national insurance contributions in 2009-10 compared with 2008-9, and this effect will be increasingly noticeable in future years. For employer contributions, there are two levels of rebate, depending on whether the contracted out occupational pension scheme is salary related or a money purchase scheme. Finally, we must mention the reduced rate for married women who have elected. This is 4.85% instead of 11% on the band between the primary threshold and the upper earnings limit. Notice that all of the rates we have considered will be increased by 0.5% from 2011-12. The main employees rate will be 11.5% instead of 11%, and the rate above the upper earnings limit will be 1.5% instead of 1%. The employer's rate will be 13.3% instead of 12.8%. Class 1 national insurance contributions are due on earnings, and over the years, employers have tried to put value into their employees' hands while not triggering a liability for contributions. The position now is that virtually all forms of remuneration are caught. Straightforward salaries and bonuses are liable to contributions, as also are benefits which can be surrendered for cash, for example premium bonds. The settlement of an employee's bill by the employer is also counted as cash remuneration. Where items are given which cannot be immediately surrendered for cash, they are still caught if they are readily convertible into cash. For example, are shares or gold bullion, where a market is always available. Finally, vouchers are caught, but one type is not, namely childcare vouchers up to £55 per week, where an income tax exemption also operates for national insurance. What happens where cash is received by an employee to reimburse business expenses, such as travel? The answer is that where the cash is to reimburse a specific and distinct business expense, no contributions are applicable. If that test is not met, then all amounts must be included in gross pay for contribution purposes. For this reason, round sum expense allowances have adverse results for national insurance purposes. Many employers streamline their compliance with the income tax rules on benefits in kind by holding a dispensation, which allows them to dispense with the P11D reporting procedure if they can show that expenses are well controlled. If this applies, the expenses covered by the dispensation are excluded from national insurance contributions. Let's now look at an example of how Class 1 national insurance contributions are calculated. Tim is paid weekly and is not in a contracted out pension scheme. In a week in 2009-10, his earnings are £1,000. We'll start with employee or primary contributions. There is nothing to pay on the first £110, and then in the band between £110 and £844, the rate is 11%, giving a liability of £80.74. From £844 up to £1,000, the rate is 1%, giving an extra 1.56 to pay, a total liability on the £1,000 of £82.30. Notice that neither the £1.56 paid at 1% nor the 11% paid on the band between £770 and £844, that's £8.14, accrue any entitlement to state pension. Moving next to employer contribution, Tim's employer has to pay 12.8% on all earnings in excess of £110, a liability of £113.92. We've seen that virtually all forms of cash or cash equivalent remuneration are caught by Class 1 contributions. But where a benefit which cannot be readily converted into cash is provided, another approach is used. This type of benefit, if provided to employees who are directors or earning over £8,500 per annum, has to be reported for income tax purposes by employers on Form P11D by the 19th of July following the tax year end. When this is done, employer contributions at the usual employer rate, currently 12.8%, have to be paid on the value of the benefits reported. Let's look at an example of how this works. Karen earns over £8,500 per annum and is provided with a car by her employer, which she can use privately. For income tax purposes, the benefit is the list price multiplied by the CO2 emissions factor. This gives an income tax liability on £4,500, and this figure is shown on Karen's P11D. As a result of this, her employer has to pay Class 1A contributions on the benefit at the 12.8% rate, a liability of £576. There's one other way in which employers may report benefits provided to employees. This is used where the benefits are minor and irregular, and where the P11D procedure would be impractical. A common example is where employers give Marks & Spencer's vouchers to employees occasionally to recognise their achievements. Under this procedure, the employer settles the tax liability of the employees so as not to put an employee in the position of receiving a gift and then having to pay tax on it. This type of benefit is liable to national insurance contributions, and therefore the employer has to pay Class 1B contributions on the amount of the settlement by the 19th of October following the year end. Let's have a look at an example of how this works. An employer has given benefits amounting to £4,200 to employees over the year. £1,200 of these were in a cash equivalent form, normally attracting Class 1 contributions, and £3,000 were benefits not readily convertible into cash. The employer works out the average income tax rate of the employees affected and settles at £1,500. The total benefit to the employees is the value of the benefits themselves plus the benefit of having their tax on them paid. So the value of both, in this case £5,700, is liable for Class 1B national insurance contributions at 12.8%. Before leaving Class 1 contributions, we must mention the special rules which apply to directors. Unlike income tax, national insurance contributions do not operate on a cumulative basis for the year, but are worked out each week for weekly paid employees or each month for monthly paid employees. This is known as the earnings period and results in lower employee contributions on remuneration which is not evenly spread throughout the year. This might tempt directors, who can control their own remuneration, to, for example, take a full year's remuneration all in one week. This would take the total beyond the upper earnings limit for the week, resulting in most of the contributions being paid at the 1% rate instead of 11%. To prevent this, the earnings period for directors is a year, irrespective of how they are actually paid. This in turn will cause bunching of employee contributions in the early part of the year and might give difficulties for directors. Therefore, the actual pay intervals can be used, provided a cumulative calculation and adjustment is done at the end of the year, usually in month 12. That concludes our review of contributions based on employment. We will now move on to consider what national insurance contributions are due from the self-employed. Self-employed are liable to two types of contribution, Class 2, a flat rate contribution which gives entitlement to benefits, and Class 4, earnings-related contributions which gives no benefits and are purely a tax. We'll begin with Class 2, which are, in 2009-10, at the rate of £2.40 per week. They are collected by direct debit from the self-employed person's bank account. So that those with very low levels of self-employed income do not have to pay, there is a small earnings exception of £5,075 in 2009-10. It's important to understand that this exception is not automatic and has to be applied for. It should be done in advance of contributions liability falling due, but in practice, HM Revenue and Customs do not pursue contributions if it's clear that the small earnings exemption would have been granted if applied for. The other matter to consider is that it is not always a good idea to apply for small earnings exception because for many people, Class 2 contributions are a relatively cheap way of maintaining entitlement to state benefits, particularly the basic state retirement pension. As we shall see shortly, the cost of doing this by means of voluntary contributions is much higher. We now move on to the other contributions due from the self-employed, namely earnings-related Class 4 contributions. The rate is 8% on the annual profits from self-employment between £5,715 and £43,875, and then 1% on profits above that amount. The contributions are collected by HM Revenue and Customs as part of the self-assessment procedure, so payment is usually made in two instalments in January and July. It's worth remembering that the National Insurance contributions on an amount paid to a self-employed person will usually be much less than those on the same amount paid to an employee. The main reason for this is the unlimited employer's liability at 12.8%. This effect is somewhat reduced by the fact that the employer's contributions are themselves a tax-deductible expense, and also by the fact that the higher employee contributions do give rise to benefits, particularly state second pension. However, there is often a strong incentive to present as self-employment, something which is really an employer-employee relationship. There have been very many cases before the courts on this subject over the years, and these should be referred to in cases of doubt. We'll next have a look at an example of how this works. In 2009-10, Sarah has profits as a self-employed person of £18,000. She pays Class 2 contributions by direct debit at £2.40 per week, giving a total cost of £124.80. As part of her income tax self-assessment, she also pays Class 4 contributions. These are 8% on earnings above £5,715, amounting to £12,285, which is £982.80. Let's now look at a self-employed person with high earnings. In 2009-10, Richard has profits as a self-employed person of £54,000. He pays his Class 2 contributions by direct debit of £2.40 a week, giving a total cost of £124.80. As part of his income tax self-assessment, he also pays Class 4 contributions. These are at 8% on earnings between £5,715 and £43,875, amounting to £38,160, which is £3,052.80, plus 1% on earnings in excess of £43,875, namely £10,125, which is £101.25. The total amount collected from Richard under the self-assessment procedure is £3,154.05. Finally, let's remind ourselves what happens when a self-employed person has low earnings. In 2009-10, Simon has profits as a self-employed person of £4,600. As his earnings are below the Class 2 small earnings exception limit, he can apply for small earnings exception and pay no Class 2 contributions. However, he may decide that he would like to keep up his contributions record at the relatively low cost of £2.40 per week and not apply. His earnings are clearly below the lower profits limit for Class 4, so there will be no liability. Before we finish by looking at the payment of voluntary contributions by non-earners, we must say what happens when there are either multiple employments or a combination of employment and self-employment. Because National Insurance does not work on a cumulative basis but simply looks at each earnings period for each employment, an individual with multiple sources of earned income would pay a very large amount in employee contributions compared with the same remuneration from a single employment. We will now see how this is prevented. Where there are two or more employments, the aim is to ensure that each individual employee pays a maximum of 11% on the difference between the primary threshold and the upper earnings limit, but does not pay that amount many times over. All contributions above that level should be at the 1% rate only. Similarly, if an individual has paid the full 11% contributions on the difference between primary threshold and the upper earnings limit in an employment, the system is designed to ensure that only contributions at the 1% rate are paid on self-employed income. If an individual has two employments and has paid excess primary contributions, this should be dealt with automatically by HM Revenue and Customs, but if not, an application for a refund should be made to the HM Revenue and Customs National Insurance Contributions Office in Newcastle upon Tyne. Similarly, where there is both employment and self-employment, a refund may be made automatically, but if not, it should be applied for. The calculation can be quite complex depending on the number of employments and the remuneration from each, and is not covered in detail in this module. A better approach in these circumstances may be to apply in advance for a deferment. To avoid the cash flow disadvantages of paying and then reclaiming contributions, an application can be made to HM Revenue and Customs National Insurance Contributions Office for a deferment. If granted, the employee will pay contributions at 1% only on remuneration from all employments other than the first. The relevant employers will be instructed to operate pay-as-you-earn on this basis. If the individual is both employed and self-employed, and earnings are likely to exceed the upper earnings limit, deferment will result in no Class 2 contributions being collected by direct debit and only 1% on self-employed earnings being collected under self-assessment. To finish this presentation, we must mention the arrangements for paying voluntary contributions. For those who are not liable to pay contributions, it may be beneficial to pay Class 3 voluntary contributions in order to maintain entitlement to benefits. This is most commonly done in relation to the benefit of the state pension, where an individual has insufficient years of contributions to give full entitlement. In the majority of cases, it turns out that the investment in the shape of Class 3 contributions gives an excellent return by securing an increased state pension for life. Notice that contributions can only be paid 6 years in arrears, so this facility will not provide a solution where many earlier years' contributions are lacking. Notice also that the Class 3 rate is much higher than Class 2 for the same benefits, so Class 2 should always be paid where there has been any form of self-employment, however small. The rate of Class 3 contributions has risen sharply between 2008-09 and 2009-10. This reflects the fact that the government has realised that paying these contributions can be a good investment, and they've probably been underpriced in the past. Where individuals wish to fill a hole in their contribution record to secure a full or at least an increased state pension, delay in dealing with the matter can result in earlier years going out of date under the 6-year rule. Notice that arrears of contributions cannot be paid more than 6 years in arrears. There is an exception to this rule, but in practice, very few individuals have been able to benefit from it. The rule is that contributions more than 6 years in arrears can be paid if the failure to pay at the time was due to ignorance or error, but not due to any failure to exercise due care or diligence. In cases which have come before the courts, the HM Revenue and Customs National Insurance Contributions Office have usually been able to show that they did communicate with the individual and that therefore there was a failure to exercise due care and diligence. There is a further problem with paying contributions in arrears. If Class 3 contributions are paid more than 2 years in arrears, then the penalty rate applies. This means they must be paid at the highest rate applicable between the date they were due and the date of payment. In the case of Class 2 contributions paid in arrears, the penalty rate applies if they are more than 1 year in arrears. Let's take an example of the sort of case where the payment of contributions in arrears can be beneficial. Valerie was born in September 1949 and will reach state pension age, 60 in her case, in September 2009. She's not currently working, but during her working life, she paid 20 years' contributions. She took time out of work to look after her children and therefore qualifies for 15 years' home responsibilities protection. If she does nothing, her state pension will be reduced and she would like to bring it up to the full amount. Whether this is worthwhile will depend on a number of factors, particularly the fact that she may receive a pension of about 60% of the full rate based on her husband's contributions when he reaches state pension age. There is a 6-year time limit for paying arrears, but as only 4 years are lacking, that will not be a problem. She can pay the two preceding years, 2008-09 and 2007-08, at the rate then in force. For 2008-09, this is 52 contributions at £8.10, which is £421.20. For 2007-08, it's 52 at £7.80, amounting to £405.60. The two earlier years are more than 2 years out of date, so the penalty rate applies, and payment must be made at the 2009-10 rate of £12.05. This gives 104 at £12.05, totalling £1,253.20. The full amount to fill the hole in Valerie's contribution record is £2,080. She'll have to work out how much extra pension she'll receive, but it's likely that after about 2.5 years, her investment will have been repaid. If it turns out that Valerie had some self-employment income, however small, during the years under review, then she should pay arrears of Class 2 contributions. In this case, all years more than 1 year in arrear have to be paid at the penalty rate, the highest rate in force between the date due and the date of payment. This gives contributions for 2008-09 of 52 at £2.30, which is £119.60, plus the three earlier years at the current rate of £2.40, giving £374.40. The total Class 2 would be £494. Depending on the pension calculation, it's likely that this amount will be recovered in extra pension within 6 months. We have now covered briefly the whole field of National Insurance contributions and have moved from areas where it's a pure tax, such as employers' Class 1 contributions, to areas where people are keen to pay because of the benefits, namely Class 3. I hope you have found this presentation informative and useful, and it will help you to improve the advice you give to clients. Goodbye.